Swords and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This time it is a live commentary, something we haven't done before, and it's going to be fun and exciting. And I have three lovely people to discuss this film with me and a live audience that we'll talk about in just a moment. But let me introduce the panelists. First up, Annette Weirstra. Hello.
Hello, Shelley. This might be my most exciting movie with you ever because it's got a linotype in it.
Spoilers, got it, Ned.
I know, sorry. I'm just so excited.
And next up, Moises Chuyon. What are you excited about?
Jane, Judy, Elroy, get in here. I just jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge.
I'm glad you got that. That was my talking points.
I'm excited about George Jetson himself, Mr. George Hanlon.
This is very exciting.
It is very exciting. Last but not least, the man whose idea this was, the man who's going to sort of lead us through the technical aspects of the live broadcast that is also this commentary. It's Mr. Glenn Fleischman, type historian, podcaster, and a whiz with Zoom technical things. Hi, Glenn.
Hello. Thank you for letting me hijack your delightful podcast and be part of, I like old movies. I like movies in which people say things like, call me on the Amici. And someone says, the Amici? You know, the telephone, like that movie. So I like things like that. I like technology films that are old. And I got recommended to this by, I got a call out, Jack Schaefer, who is a media writer at Politico of many decades standing. He won't mind me ribbing him about that. And he said, you got to watch Park Row. And it took me forever. I finally glanced through it and was like, oh my God, we got to do this movie as a podcast live commentary because there's so much to talk about. And so I was very excited that you were interested in doing it and you know, potentially amputations, explosions, and linotype. It's what could be better in a film. And joining us also is a live audience. People are watching our live commentary so they could ask questions. So we are going to record this in synchrony with the playback of the movie. And the version of the movie we have has a little bit of, you can watch it on YouTube, and there's a URL we'll post in the show notes. If you're listening to this on the podcast later, you just search for Park Row Movie on YouTube. You can find it and watch it. It's 1 hour and 23 minutes long. We have one that has a little preamble we're going to skip over. So we start when the lion roars on the MGM, the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer logo. So that's where we're going to start. So folks, if you are listening along and want to play the home version of this game, advance yourself to the frame where you see a lion about to yawn very broadly because they poked him. Long dead lion has been poked with a stick. And that's where we're going to go. Shelley, anything else before we get started?
Just really quickly. So the movie is Park Row, as Glenn mentioned, directed by Sam Fuller. It was made in 1952 with a cast of mostly unknown people. I'm sure we'll get to some of those. We've already talked about George Jetson, who is very definitely in this movie. And I guess that's all the preamble you need. There are other places you can watch this. I believe it's on Amazon Prime as well, but YouTube is free and that's really good. And yeah, Glenn, let's go.
That's great. And if you're, again, if you're watching along right now, we will answer questions. I'm keeping a window open as an experiment. So people say like, hey, what is that thing they're showing? I will try to butt in at some point and say, but okay, so let's,
if you're listening to this later, as I always say, when we do commentaries for Agents of Smooch, make sure that you have smart speed and, and shorten silences off because it will completely throw off the timing of everything if you have them on.
You will get out of sync with us, and then you will be wondering why we're talking about explosions at the wrong time.
An explosion that already happened or might be about to happen.
So if you're listening live or you're listening in delayed form, I'm going to count down 3, 2, 1, and then all of us watching are going to press our play buttons at the lion about to roar. Is everyone ready?
Ready, ready.
All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1, play. Oh, I heard a roar.
Oh, how lion roars.
Exciting so far.
You go, Leo.
That's some nice looking wood type there, even on the intro.
Now, I'm a big Sam Fuller fan. I'm a big fan of this movie as well. As topics come through, I love ones that I don't have to do much homework for because I already know an insufferable amount of things about them.
I want to point out quickly before this screen goes away, though, 1772 daily newspapers in the United States. This recording, there's at least 5 of those left. Okay, go ahead, Moises.
Sam Fuller self-financed this movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it almost bankrupted him. It
because
did so
Fox
poorly.
Wanted to turn it into a musical, and he was like, no, let's not do that. I'll finance it myself.
I mean, of the people that are in this, most of them are unknowns. I mentioned George O'Hanlon, who people know better as the voice of George Jetson. 10 years before this, he was well known for a series of shorts that playing a character named Joe McDokes.
And I just gotta interrupt you. That's backwards, of course, because that type would be reversed if it were being held correctly in the hand. All right, sorry, go ahead. Doesn't that look like the devil? All the statues in this movie are terrible. All right, sorry, Moises.
Hello, this is a statue of Lucifer.
Printer's devil, as we'll discover later.
So O'Hanlon played this character named Joe McDokes, and it was American common slang at the time to call just an average person. Where the term average Joe comes from is calling somebody a Joe Dokes. So Joe McDokes was the hard luck guy who was always behind the eight ball. There's a giant eight ball that he showed up in the title screen of each of these things. So he was well known to American movie going audiences because he would do things that I guess in later years, Disney would make shorts about with Goofy.
We're looking at the Benjamin Franklin. So there's all these statues. There's three statues that are significant. We just saw the Benjamin Franklin one, which I believe was legitimate. So I don't know how these are. This is something you mentioned. This almost bankrupted him. As I understand it from reading a little history, he spent half of the $200,000 budget in 1952 on building a way too authentic replica of this famous newspaper street in New York, right? And you can see they're walking around and it's almost a practical set. So that includes these horrible statues. Okay, that's all I wanted to say.
And you're going
to
see
can
this
I just
set.
Say, yeah. I just saw Otmar Morgenthaler's name come up as a character and I'm super excited.
Possibly the only movie that Otmar Morgenthaler appears as a character.
I want to name a cat Otmar sometime because...
Otmar.
Good name for a cat.
I will tell you later about James Clefane as we get closer to who's not in this film, should be in this film possibly, but I'll tell you more later. So Moises, I'm sorry. So our friend, Joe Dokes.
I was mostly to the end of the thought, but he was one of the better known actors in this. And so when you see him in this and without the context, people might see this movie and go, oh, this must be where George Jetson got his start. Well, he was almost like, I don't know, the short film version of a vaudeville star at this point, where people knew this guy and they're like, oh, it's that guy. I know him from the shorts where he's trying to wash his hair with beer or something.
I should point out, too, this bar scene is actually really authentic in a very particular way. I'm sorry, I don't want to talk over her incredible patter, which is amazing, but beside the point.
All right, no, this is important. This is I have cocktail content.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You go ahead and I'll come back to the bar.
Cocktails that she is listing right now. These are cocktails that are appropriate to the time, but cocktails as a thing happened in the late 1870s with Jerry Thomas, who was a bartender in New York, and New York was really the center of the cocktail becoming a thing. And so she's listed this incredible number of cocktails, which for this kind of bar is sort of ridiculous. But one of them I would drink.
This is a printer's bar. And so the printers and typesetters, they weren't like union bars exactly, but they had specific places they went to. There were tons of people employed in the field and they would work like a typesetter would go in. You'll see type distribution, the exciting act of type distribution later in this movie. So they distribute their type for the night before in the afternoon. Then they'd go drink and eat. Then they'd come back and work like 10 hours overnight. Then at like 4 a.m., they'd be done. They'd go and drink in the bar for 2 to 5 hours. Then they would somehow sleep and get up at, 2 o'clock and do this 6 days, sometimes 7 days a week. So typesetters lived about 40 to 45 years on average in the late 1800s. Until the invention of a machine depicted in this movie, because they lived really bad lives and they liked to lick lead type also. And
probably most of them drinking that beer that man is holding as opposed to all those cocktails.
Not so good.
On the boozing front, Shelley, I feel like I should pop in and say, cocktails are a thing, but there are things that are highballs that people think are cocktails, but that are actually highballs.
True. Oh, that's confusing.
Oh, booze.
That is. But tell me, because I don't know. What is the
highball predates a cocktail? And there are, a cocktail can be a highball.
Hey, I got to break in one second about cocktails.
It's the square and the rectangle of booze is what it is.
This is a movie. This is a movie in which a dejected newspaper man just says, oh, go jump off the Brooklyn Bridge. Go kill yourself. Sorry for the trigger warning, lack of trigger warning. But the sort of the trigger point for this film is, you should go kill yourself. Like that'll get a lot of news. Like, wait, what? That's how the film starts.
Awkward.
Also, friends, this is what you get when you go along on a commentary with a bunch of nerds who think they know things. We all think we know things.
Everything I know about linotypes is from the Linotype documentary that I'm obsessed with.
the Linotype of the movie, or sorry, the Linotype of the film, rather, by Doug Thomas. Very nice fella.
I kickstarted it, and it talks a lot about Otmore and the Linotype machine, and I've watched it like 20 times.
I'll proudly say that I've watched it, but I probably retained less than the average person did from it, and I'm just along for the ride to learn about Linotype.
Longest bar in the world, exciting. Friends. Longest bar in the world.
Yep, this movie is just about industrialization of printing, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Is this a sad story? I need to be prepared.
It's not particularly.
Okay.
What's the fella on the, who's the fella on the left there? I've lost track. It's the actor playing the older reporter. Herbert Hayes, I think. Josiah Davenport, isn't that him? His manner, it's like he's in the most serious thing ever made. It's so funny. Like, yes, here we go. I mean, this is pretty dark.
This is dark.
But it gets better.
Murdered by the star.
I love the fade into this to her with the hat and everything.
With a fantastic outfit, because I'm usually wonderful. Here for the costume.
She gives me Helen Walker vibes. I thought it was her, and then I was like, oh, that's not Helen Walker. I don't even know who this, I don't know her name. I don't know Mary Welch, but.
Yeah, Mary Welch, I know from this, and I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, the Criterion Collection put out a box set called The Golden Age of Television that had Philco Television Playhouse and Playhouse 90 and various different kinescope recordings of teleplays. And she was in The Day the Train Stopped Running. Here it is. And so I had seen her or I'm Still Alive. One of the two. I saw her in this thing. I didn't remember the thing in particular, but I went, oh, yeah, I have seen her face before in exactly one thing.
She's great. And actually, all of these unknown actors, there's nobody in here that you're like, oh, you couldn't get a good actor, so you got these people. They're just people that don't happen to have had the careers. I mean, they're character actors that you sort of go, oh, yeah, I recognize that guy, but I can't really think of what he's been in. But she's really quite good.
She died young, right? That's the sad part, is she only lived into her 30s, I think. So I got to think about her career, because she was really, I thought, you know, it's a melodramatic movie, but she's really quite good in it, I thought. Very enjoyable.
Women with a cane like that, tapping people.
When I say Helen Walker vibes, for people who aren't old movie nerds, we watched a movie called Nightmare Alley a while back. And she is the female, she's the person who is more of a scammer than Tyrone Power, as it turns out.
I note that they mentioned the illustrator's name is Thomas Guest, as opposed to the illustrator of the time, Thomas Nast, right? But I guess they decided they could use Otmar Mergenthaler's name, but not Thomas Nast's name, without fear of lawsuit or something. Somebody told me there was actually Mergenthaler, the Linotype company, which was still vibrant in 1952, was angry and apparently maybe threatened some action about this film because it, you know, misled people about the creation.
How dare they besmirch the history of type?
I know.
And then the proud American tradition of suing people.
Yes, the little matte painting of a man jumping off a bridge.
I want to mention a couple of things about Gene Evans.
Really
Gene Evans, a favorite of Sam Fuller's at the time, started in The Steel Helmet, less seen among Sam Fuller's later movies like The Wild Bunch and various other things. See, if you haven't clocked him as the voice of George Jetson, you sure do once he walks in and starts shouting.
he's very enthusiastic.
He's committed like to that role.
That nobody's given the woman who's the bartender, no one's given her a hard time as the bartender, which is great. And she actually seems to like this palooka, this mug.
And he's not in the movie for very long, but he really commits to his role, as he should.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one of my favorite things about this film, I got to say, is that he's like, yeah, I always wanted to start a film, a newspaper. So did I. Well, let's do it tonight. And I just, the energy behind that is incredible.
That's how we start podcasts now.
That's right? My gosh.
That's absolutely, that kind of true, actually.
I don't need a lot of time to start a podcast. It's
100%
true. And I'll edit it. And then that person quits 3 weeks in.
Right. Yeah, it's like, that's a lot of work, and it's over.
That's right. I've always wanted to produce a podcast, and I have some equipment in my office you can come use.
All you need is a mic and a computer. Anyone can be a podcaster.
And I'm going to splice it, the physical tape together. It's going to be like the Linotype days.
Oh, my goodness.
That's only for hipsters. Real podcast.
Artisanal podcasting with tape.
I tell you what, Mr. Fleischman, I think it would be fun to run a newspaper. I'm going to write a whole declaration of principles. I'm going to hire a staff of people. I'm going to abuse them all and then die a sad old man.
What if I hired every drunk at this bar? That seems like a great idea.
I know. Yeah, just because you're in the bar that night, that qualifies you to work on the paper.
That's good. That is not a good drawing. I think any barista would be embarrassed by Thomas Guest's work there.
That looks like a delicious drink.
I thought it was a straw, and I'm a little sad he's not drinking it. Is it a cat?
Everyone's teeth would have been rotted at this time, and they had to use swizzle sticks to keep the ice from breaking their teeth, right? Isn't that the old...
I like the way these shots emphasize the glasses. It's just both the full ones and the empty ones. It's very picturesque.
It's really tight on them. I like it. It makes it feel very hectic.
The whole movie is kind of like, there's a lot of close-ups and because there's this intensity. People have ideals and they have plans and they have things they want to do. And so there's a lot of close-ups.
I love the man.
Also, those drinks are huge.
They're enormous. They're going to be warm right away almost.
The typesetter. What's his name? Mr. Angelo. Mr. Angelo with the giant.
Oh, he's great.
That huge hat, the beautiful hat. Very elegant looking person. I don't know anything about the actor. He doesn't even show up in the Wikipedia.
His name is Don Orlando.
Don Orlando. Tony Orlando and Don.
Sure, it's his dad, clearly.
Yes. So job printer. Here's my type insight. So job printer. This is actually, that's a few decades after that hipster Walt Whitman printed his book, Leaves of Grass, his book of poetry, in a Brooklyn print shop with his buddy. So job shops, you'd have newspapers, right, that were sending newspapers, had typesetters working every day, every night, and printers and so forth, putting out typically daily editions. But job shops did all the boring stuff that continues to happen today.
Flyers and postcards.
Business cards, all that nonsense. And so a job shop had kind of a motley array of type. They didn't necessarily, the finances could be really tight. They couldn't keep a lot of standing type, so they would set something, print it, get it out the door, and immediately distribute the type so they could use it for the next job. And job printers persisted, really until 1950s, even later. I mean, there's still job printers technically today, but even like people doing handset type persisted a long time because there's a lot of value in what you're printing as opposed to the number of words on the thing. So anyway, it's not unrealistic because again, this is how a lot of books, you go into a job shop, you'd be like, I want to do a book. And they'd be like, yeah, but you can only set up like 4 pages at a time. So you better get them right. Because once we set those 4 pages, we're going to tear those pages, the type all apart. And again, that's how Walt Whitman printed Leaves of Grass.
I really enjoy the intensity of our printer here. He's because he's not being talked into it by the publisher, by the guy who wants to do it. I mean, obviously he wants to do it, but you can tell they're going to be a good team because they're both committed to it in different ways. And later on, he talks about journalism, which totally surprised me. I was like, the guy's literally an ink-stained wretch in the sense that he's doing printing as opposed to going out and writing stories, and you'll find out that this movie is much more about the production aspects of newspapers than what's in them, although there's some of that.
If this were back then, I would have to issue a whole new edition of the paper to correct something that I messed up earlier, because Gene Evans worked with two different directors named Sam, one named Sam Peckinpah, who's the director of The Wild Bunch, he worked on Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid with Peckinpah. But he was also later, I don't know, like 10 years later in shot corridor for Fuller. And as a Texan, I feel it behooves me to mention anybody who was ever associated with any Alamo project. Gene Evans was in Alamo 13 Days to Glory in the 80s and just, has always kind of had this aspect to him in the characters that he played. Tough, takes no guff, and just kind of, straight ahead, straight shooter kind of a guy.
Pink pills for ale people. I don't know what that means, but I want some pink pills.
It means people knew how to have a good time in the 1800s.
Interesting. Just turn them off. Turn them over to the cops.
Well, who needs enemies when you have friends like these?
That's right. And then he starts to sketch out the front page. There's such some hilarious, nice, I mean, shot. This is, of course, before the ready availability of halftone photographs, by the way. Although the transition in, this takes place, what, in 1886, I think, or supposedly? The transition to, 1886. The transition to halftone photography was just about to happen, throwing an enormous number of illustrators and wood engravers out of work. And what they did is become cartoonists and invented cartooning. And that's why we have cartoons, because they knew how to draw and no one wanted them to draw images of events anymore. So they said, we will draw images of things that never happened and are funny. Now that's one theory, at least.
Now we're meeting the print devil, Rusty. It's always interesting to see whether the child in a movie is really terrible or really delightful. I'm going to come down on delightful on this side because he's not overdoing it. I mean, he's cute and he's, you know, he's a mascot. They're going to put him to work. And he's the printer's devil. Yeah. And I enjoy him.
Real job. I was visiting with my in-laws years ago at a retirement place they were at. And one of the fellows at the table with them was a guy we'd met a number of times. He was 90. And we're talking about something. And I forget, something about printing comes up. He said, oh, I was a printer's devil. And I said, you were a printer's devil? He's like, yeah, and he's 90. So he was a printer's devil in, I got to do the math, like the 1930s or early 40s. And I was like, tell me about it. And he told me a few things. You know, he recounted a few things. But it was mostly, he's like, what'd you do? And he's like, I swept up, scraped the lead off the scum off the top of the lead when it was melted down to put it back in the pots for the linotype and so forth. But, you know, it was scut work, but yeah.
I have to mention this statue here. Not that bad.
Well, this is the Horace Greeley statue, right? I mean, it's not good. Well, look at that angle though. Come on.
There we go. That's what I mean. That one's not that bad until you get a close look at it.
This angle, no, you're totally, this angle's good.
Yeah.
Horace Greeley. How long ago?
But that angle, it looks like he's being possessed from behind.
the reverence for things like this, statues, and you'll see it with photos later, is just, again, the earnestness of this movie, because they really do. There's no irony at all in the way that they gaze upon these pioneers of their profession.
I feel like I never want a statue made of me ever. But that's,
I mean, what could possibly go right about it? It just doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful print shop covered in rags.
So this is, at this point, they are not using the linotype.
Well, the linotype isn't in the shop yet. We haven't got to the linotype part yet.
Right. Oh. Okay. There's so much before the linotype.
I'm so really excited.
Sexy.
This is somebody who's just getting hot. Yeah, he's getting hot for standing in a shop, smells of ink, and this is past the days.
Well, don't we all? Isn't this us all see printmaking things? Well,
I mean, it's...
I'd throw over my job to go be like an artisanal printmaker, honestly.
Is it sad that the movie almost bankrupted Sam Fuller? Yes. Am I glad that he went to the lengths that he did such that it almost bankrupted him? Yes.
It's a great film.
Because it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
And it's so different from a lot of the other things he did. It's just delightful. It's a postcard to something that he really
liked. What else has he done?
Naked Kiss and Shock Quarter to Pick Up on South Street's great.
Yeah. We talked about that in LTS a while back. More his movies tended to be sort of violent and sort of like explosive violence. You'll see them again. We'll see bombs here later. But this movie, you wouldn't know that it's him just in terms of the tone of the movie. I'm not a sophisticated enough understanding of cinematography to know whether this is typically the way he films things. But it's not similar to Pick Up on South Street, which is the most recent Fuller I've seen.
Yeah. And I mean, he did lots of war and conflict stuff. The Steel Helmet, Baron of Arizona with Vincent Price, if I have that right in the back of my head, 40 Guns, Run of the Arrow, a bunch of stuff with people shooting at each other and riding horses against each other.
I don't do war movies, so that's probably why I don't.
couple print things here too, because it's actually this film is actually, despite some issues with the Linotype Convention, which isn't too far off, we'll see. So much of the detail is accurate because he was a newspaper man, and he actually must have worked in shops that were not very different from this. So all the stuff going on here is all really familiar, and including the fact that the guy bought a press that was too big, because you'd have these smaller compact job presses for doing the sorts of printing you need to do. This scene where they're going to start distributing the type. Now, what's ridiculous here, that's a hell box. And as they describe later, I mean, they actually use all these correct terms, so I'm doing this ahead of time. But the hell box is full of type that was not distributed. But that's not how typically a hell box wasn't that full. Each typesetter would go through and they'd take the previous day's work and they would distribute it from, you know, by hand. They wouldn't throw it into a box because then it's this massive mess. Instead, they have a much smaller set of letters. But it cracks me up how fast they're going. This is possibly not totally reliable, but there you go.
I mean, I may have mischaracterized Sam Fuller as primarily a war film director. I mean, there's a couple of things that are war based, but he tends toward the seedier aspects of stuff. You know, Naked Kiss is about a sex worker who wants to start a new life. Various movies set in and around this time are about people cheating each other and, you know, getting the raw end of the deal and good, hopefully winning out over bad at the end of things. But I mean, he made a movie called Underworld USA, and he was very interested in not necessarily the aristocratic class, the decision-making class, but the people getting their hands dirty and doing work, or just trying to make it in the world. And then he made one about training a dog to be racist.
What?
I just have to say that the scene where they're zooming in on the little kid being, that's like a good example of that earnestness, Shelley.
Yeah.
His eyes are giant and watching and listening, being like, I'm amazed by everything you're saying. Like, what kid would listen to that? But
I just like to point out that that kid directed an episode of Airwolf in 1985. Just so
we have Airwolf.
He did, things as an adult, but he didn't have a huge career thereafter.
No, but he did great. He was in a lot of films in that era. He was a really cute kid. He's good. I mean, he's good for a kid actor in that time. Is just the right thing, but
overplaying. He's got the enthusiasm down, the earnestness that works for them.
I don't want to murder him.
He's pretty good. They're all wearing the forearm things. They've got those garter-like things over there. I forget what those are called, over their front sleeves to keep them from getting covered in ink while they're writing with pens.
And visors.
The visors are great.
Yeah. All the equipment these guys are having to wear, and by equipment, you know, I include things that are made of fabric. It's delightful. It evokes that specific era so perfectly.
The timing is amazing too. I mean, this is the verisimilitude. He did his research because steam operated press, probably in that era at that point, it would be hard. You wouldn't get distributed electricity in a city. It was more likely you'd have to have your own dynamo, which are hard to operate. Mm-hmm. So just before electrification really would have kicked in. I mean, this is Philadelphia, so it's a big city, but I think even when we get to the Linotype, like I think the Linotype is steam driven here, but so electricity, I mean, literally just years away at most. I bet there was some electrification for streetlights, although they're still letting some other things, but
here's this is a great bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. He can't read. This is a beautiful scene.
This.
I will point out that it is completely ridiculous that one person could have set even the size of the newspaper that they were putting out by hand. It would have probably taken at least two people to do that, and they would have spent 10 hours to do it. The labor issue was huge, and it was very, very hard to keep typesetters because they were, as I said, they drank and slept and died young, and they traveled a lot because they could work anywhere because they were always in demand because the skill was highly refined.
The beauty of the choreography of this bit right here is that they're not worrying about 4K and HDR and whether somebody can zoom in and look at it and see if that actually makes any sense or if it's all gobbledygook.
Get the original prints.
He just has to sell that he is very good and very fast and very accurate at this.
Now, I have a book from this era written just about this time called, or I have a scan of it called A Collation of Facts Related to Fast Typesetting. And it's a book about typesetting races, which were popular in the mid 1880s.
Typing tests and stuff too.
They would go, people would go to Dime, what are they called? Not Nickelodeons, but they were like a Dime thing. And they would go to, I forgot the name of it, but they would go and pay, you know, 5 or 10 cents to watch people set type really fast. It was a huge thing, just like typing competitions. There were a lot of these work sport competitions in the late 1800s. And the fastest people, if I'm remembering right, they could, there was a, the fastest typesetter could set 2,200 words, or no, 2,200 M's an hour, which is about 7,000 characters an hour.
I enjoyed watching the printer, by the way, too. That was something
that was genuine, really, too.
Yeah.
They were really printing. Sorry.
I was going to say. I just found it another. There's so much mechanical stuff to watch and enjoy this movie.
Oh, it's also ridiculous.
To follow up on that and tagging back to the, you know, the sleeve covers and the visors and everything, there are elements within this movie that you see as, you know, this is a production signpost of this person works in a print shop and this person does this. But in this movie, you're getting all of it all at once. And it's really lovely looking at it. If you have ever had to production design anything or produce anything or direct anything, the attention to detail is, even if you're not catching everything that's, oh yes, that is actually historically accurate, it all looks and feels right. Mm-hmm. And it's okay if you don't have the checklist of everything being right or wrong, because it all plays nicely together. Frankly, it's something that I can see this movie being something that lives in history, not just on its own merits, but as an important production design artifact of, this is one that got all of it right.
Yeah, this is it's not just verisimilitude. I think I used that word earlier for some reason, but it's like, it's just accurate. Like, they actually, this is how, you know, with some shortening of time, so it wasn't tedious and they didn't have, like, you know, 10 people working in a tiny space to show how certain things were done. It was definitely how this was done. But I do love that they didn't have,
it creates a mood as well, because the shots are very close. The people are very close together. They don't really talk about it, but you get the sense it's very warm in there, but everybody is so earnest and so committed to what they're doing that they sort of bring you along, because if you just describe what was happening in this movie, it would sound much more tedious than it actually turns out to be.
It's like, you know, that's what I say. It's a movie about newspapers, but that's why I always mention the amputation or near amputation part. It's very important. Explosions. And this was before, I think it's just before the process was developed to make cheap wood pulp paper. Oh, very good.
Just look at that depth of field, very as nice. You were saying, Glenn. Just
oh, no, sorry. No, that's beautiful. I'm glad.
Look at that.
I like it. It was hard. Paper was very expensive in relative terms, because it wasn't being made from the wood pulp process that became, it's famous for, like, the cheap paperback novels that, like, practically burn up. They yellow so fast because there's no, they're so acidic. So they're using, like, you know, it's sort of very nice, relatively nice paper. So the butcher paper even would not have been terrible, just thin. It's a cute film. It's good incidental music.
I like that they also have pictures as well as statues to celebrate them.
Yes. Statues outside, pictures inside.
So is this all done on a single soundstage?
Yeah.
With this set? Because far
he built
it looks
this
like
set,
everything.
Which is what cost him so much money.
Yeah.
Like, I think half of the cost of the film was the set.
This is the Apocalypse Now of newspaper movies. Not quite. It's a good panning scene, though, isn't it? They're driving along the set.
He's done several pans that are nice. He did the first one I noticed was in the bar, and then there was another one a little later, I think, through the shop.
And now when they break him out, when they break Steve out, the little parade it's a beautiful shot.
That's great. This is the Bowery, right? This is the Bowery of the Bowery Boys. Well, not quite there later, but it's low down, rough and
the Bowery
tumble.
Of the Bowery Boys' grandfathers.
Yeah. Of course, there was also, this is Park Row. There was a typewriter row in the lower Manhattan at the time, too, where all the typewriter shops were, all these, like, dozens and dozens of companies making typewriters, which were only Remington. Well, the typewriter really only came into its own about 10 years before this movie ostensibly is set, when Remington bought the patent from Scholes and Glidden. And Scholes decided he could never make a perfect typewriter, and he kept working to the end of his life on revised ones. And Glidden died with very little money because he didn't manage it very well. That's very sad. Typewriters are very sad. Mergenthaler died young, I'm sorry to tell you. The guy who invented the monotype
didn't really benefit either from his invention, did he?
Mergenthaler or
Mergenthaler. Scholes?
Yeah, he did okay, but I think he died before he had sold some rights. And oh, here we go. Here's Otmar.
I'm so excited.
Here's Otmar.
My future cat.
So
the hero of the movie is a guy named Otmar. I love that so much.
I do like that he said, you talk to this machine and it sets type. I think it's a very clever idea, though. It's the predecessor of voice recognition. Mr. Angelo was ahead of his time.
Hey, Apple lady, make a newspaper.
Make newspaper. And Mergenthaler is not lying here. This is actually, again, the Fuller actually understanding his own business is Mr. Angelo is like, oh, you're going to put me out of business. He's like, no, there's going to be more work for you. We'll train you how to use it. And that's exactly what happened is in the short term, the Linotype did actually put some compositors out of business. And then very quickly, like within not like years, but months practically, the demand crept up so quickly that they just need to hire and train a vast number of new people to produce bigger newspapers because they could make them more cheaply and thus sell more copies.
Wikipedia says they also increased at 45
the amount of things printed because it became easier. So it just like vastly increased the ability to print things.
Yeah, and reduced the cost, and it made it easier for them to. I mean, the typesetters union remains strong. The typesetters union persists to this day, although not with as many members. I think the ITU. Yeah, here we go. Mr. Angelo is like, you're gonna.
His accent almost sounded like a El Brendel in a minute.
Accents in this movie are just incredible.
I don't know about accents. Give me the good old days.
Wait, so you give me a job and I do it. I pay you money. I don't know if I like this work on a newspaper. I did not understand that. It's good. Why are the scissors on a string? This thing I don't understand.
So you never lose them?
I don't know. He's cutting something. What is he doing?
He's cutting up galleys. Is it on a string or an elastic?
Yeah, I guess if he has to pick things up, he doesn't want to have to put the scissors down or hold them.
He's cutting galleys to paste up he's got proofs all around him. He's cutting stuff up to assemble the paper.
Well, when you have that much paper around.
I did the modern version of that in the very early days of my career as an intern.
Huh. Excellent.
And the scissors could get lost under piles of paper all over the place. So that way you don't lose them.
Right. Scissors probably cost $1,000 then in modern money. We don't know. Everything was expensive. For certain things were not. Labor was cheap. Tools were expensive. I like he said, I have remarks off the cuff, and then he literally hands him his cuff. I think that's probably both legitimate, but also very funny. See, he's full of journalistic integrity. He tells someone to jump off a bridge, then he sends gangs to a police holding cell to liberate someone. He's full of journalistic integrity.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, there's no slow news days this way.
That's right.
Well, if he's talking about wanting to have 3 or 4 editions out a day, he's going to have a lot of filling to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. That's all. It's mentioned later. I'll wait.
Yeah, that's coming up. Sorry.
I got things to say about editions.
Would an edition be entirely new, or would they add to it?
Well, it could change. The first page and the inside page, the first page continue to, would often change and other stuff wouldn't. But some papers had like a separate morning and evening edition, and they could be substantially different. But some newspapers, they would put out 10 editions in a day of the same paper, and they would change out parts and sometimes substantial parts. So like the Chicago, it wasn't the Tribune, it was another paper. There's a guy who was a production editor, wrote a book decades ago that I found not too long ago where he's just describing like the production of papers. And he was like, you know, the first newspaper went out to the hinterlands. They would send it out by truck to, 100 miles away from Chicago, and they just kept updating editions like web pages.
It's also how you got theater reviews in the middle of the night so that people after the play could sit up and wait for the reviews, because they would come out with an edition just for that, because the reviewer would run home from the play or run to the office for the play, type it up, and they'd make a new edition, and there'd probably be another new one by morning.
This is a great
get ready to be deflated by Deflator Mouse.
This is Moises. This is the scene you were highlighting earlier. Yep. It's just sort of ridiculous. There's Mr. Angelo pointing. He doesn't know why he's there. It's just, right.
Shouldn't he be setting time for drinking?
They said, get on the streetcar, and I was drunk already. So,
hello, Dr. Nick.
I like that she's inside and she's still wearing her hat. She never takes that hat off.
Oh, well, I have a unified theory of the two newspapers is that everybody on her side dresses far more formally. The men keep their jackets on. Of course, the men she's talking to are not her production staff. They're her editors and her flunkies and such.
I love that guy's beard. And he's also he's pretty right on. Like, he tells her the truth, and he's, you know, she's got another flunky who does not. But he's like, yep, it's, you know, I see one good newspaper like that a year and it comes and goes. And it's like,
you get the sense that a lot, I mean, they say it, they imply it earlier, but that a lot of papers happen. The idea that somebody would start a new paper is not that unusual. That it would succeed would be the unusual thing.
Makes a sense. It's like a lot of businesses. Just the capital to do it is the tricky part, unless you can find exactly that job printer.
Unless you have a job printer who's like, oh, hey, sure, I'll print your newspaper as long as you pay me before I print it, because...
Actually, what probably happened is I bet there were successive bankruptcies where it's like,
right, well, and your press gets pulled out from under you.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, all right, I just got this press for 10 cents on the dollar. I can print a newspaper. And then it's sold for 1 cent on the dollar. But this is right at the era in which newspaper presses sped up dramatically also. I will not get into a flong conversation, I swear. I promise. But this is a point at which they were able to, so this is actually a great movie because it's kind of about, at one level, because I'm into that sort of thing. It's the thing that was.
I love that you keep having to go, I promise this is a good movie.
Glenn, sorry,
no, believe you.
We believe you, Glenn. We're here.
We believe you.
It's about the point where the speed of typesetting was what was holding newspapers back. The presses had increased in speed. The way to produce metal plates for doing high speed rotary press production had improved. So they could print newspapers far faster than they could create content to fill it. And it was actually holding back the progress of news coverage. And so that's what our dear friend Otmar's, that's what he's here about. This is historically accurate too. This whole base of the Statue of Liberty, right? This all, I didn't look up whether it was accurate. I think it is, though. There was a whole thing about
it. I think it is. I don't know what paper. Yeah, I think they're probably taking from truth that there was a paper that actually, because I remember that U.S. people had to raise the money for the pedestal, but I don't know if it was done as a newspaper thing or what.
Here, Shelley, here's some notes off the cuff.
Is that where this saying comes from, though?
I think maybe. I think that's great. I'm going to look at, I'm going to do real-time
follow-up. Currently not wearing cuffs.
Real-time Googling.
Yeah, people writing on their cuffs has been a thing I've seen in other movies too. And it's something that, I mean, sure, some people who will go unnamed did things like this to cheat on tests in school. Right. no one of the upstanding caliber who's on this recording, of course.
Of course not.
Did you wear a tie or a cravat when you had your removable cuffs in school?
Glenn, you know I'm a cravat man.
I was like, if it's not a cravat, Moises, I'd be so disappointed.
Did I not mention that we all had to wear cravats in order to get onto this
podcast? I have a very fancy hat on right now.
It could have been an ascot.
If everyone's watch chains are not prominently displayed, I'll be quite disappointed.
Oh, sorry, Glenn didn't turn on the video, but we all have our watch chains on.
Glenn,
I'm wearing my visor,
Glenn has misplaced his Statue of Liberty commemorative fob, but the chain is there, trust us.
I am artfully sitting on a chair because I have so many bustles on, I can't really sit down.
So your many
hat
bustles.
Is really fetching. I agree.
Well, the hat has to fit around the headphones. So, it's got to be an art.
I'm just going to say the one place in which Fuller stinted was on illustration, because his illustrations are kind of almost terrible. They're not bad. They're almost bad. But also, like, if this is the wood, I think they would, there's a mention in passing, doesn't Guest say something about, oh, there's this new zinc process, which of course got me very excited because of course they were doing photo etching onto zinc plates, a process that was only then, this is the transition to photographic, some photographic processes. because wood engraving took forever. So there were a lot of weekly illustrated papers. At this point, you had, it was like the London Illustrated Weekly and the Graphic in London that would compete each week to have these massive publications full of woodcut illustrations, some of them like, you know, 2 feet by 3 feet. And Harper's Weekly in the U.S., founded by the Harper brothers.
I laugh because nothing gets Glenn more excited than zinc.
Zinc,
I tell you. Point out she has a portrait, I think, of herself with the printing accoutrements or something. I just saw a glimpse of it, but
I love it. She's wearing a cane.
I love her.
She, the editor of a newspaper who walks into a bar not knowing that she employs half the people in the bar.
That's right. Oh, that was great.
About her, I'm saying she's an awesome person.
She is. And we don't have to deal with the usual tropes of a woman owning a newspaper. It's just like, okay, a woman owns a newspaper, deal with it. And she has a connection to the guy across the street, which we'll see more of later. But it doesn't prevent her from being an awesome person through most of the
movie. Right. And part of her growth arc is like that disconnection from knowing the salt of the earth people in the print shop that are doing the production stuff. That's part of her journey is being less disconnected from that, where the layers of crap in between her and that are things that she does not in fact want. It's just something that she kind of took for granted as the way that the business was being run. And she's a good person. She's not somebody who's scolded for being somehow inherently evil.
And it's starting now as she's meeting Mergenthaler and she's going to learn about him.
She's smart.
She speaks French. I mean, we find out later she speaks French. She makes an educated joke. She knows to make a joke about Stuttgart to someone from Württemberg. And she speaks German.
I laughed at that joke.
I've been to Stuttgart.
Sorry, lady, you've lost all the people from Stuttgart.
Stuttgart has an area with a version of my husband's last name. And we stayed in a hotel, the Hotel Feuerbach in Stuttgart. So I'll always have a kind thought in my heart for Stuttgart.
Aww.
I stayed with my friend's family in Stuttgart.
This Mark Twain reference to the page compositor, the thing that ruined Mark Twain. And the problem was the page compositor was in competition with the Linotype. Because in reality, Ottmar was working on this for like 12 years. So there was this guy. Let me tell you the story, because this is all they're talking about, right? So James Clefane was a celebrity stenographer of the 1860s and later. He was, a Scottish immigrant and Irish immigrant. And he was like a friend of Abraham Lincoln, a friend of famous people and politicians of the time, because he was such a superb stenographer. And it was an incredible demand for court hearings, for public events and so forth. And he was obsessed with finding a way to translate stenography into copies much faster, both to get it out quickly, to turn shorthand into something printed or distributable, but also to make many copies of it at the same time. So he funded all these different ventures, and Glidden and Scholes had an exchange about Clefane and the typewriter. They sent him beta versions of the typewriter in the late 1860s, early 1870s, and he would destroy them and send back scathing notes, but super detailed ones. And at one point, Scholes, who is very thin-skinned, sends a note to Glidden like, I can't take it anymore, this Clefane. And Glidden writes back like, look, we have gotten more out of this beta tester, I'm using modern language, than we have at almost anything else we've done. We need his help. So Clefane, not liking the typewriter, I mean, eventually, you know, sort of not funding the typewriter, but being helpful in its actual move towards production after many people had tried over decades, he wound up, walks into a shop, meets Ottmar Mergenthaler, fresh from Württemberg, and eventually hires the shop and then him, and over like 14 years, funds different kinds of ideas, including making like soft molds, a machine that would stamp into soft paper and you'd pour metal into it, until Mergenthaler finally came up with the idea that's shown here. That's very clever and actually pretty well explained. So anyway, that's the James Clefane story. A person who had more to do, helped invent the typewriter and the typesetting machine. Mark Twain's, the machine he funded, it was so complicated. I mean, the Linotype is ridiculously complicated. The page compositor apparently worked just fine, but it didn't work for very long before it broke down. So you're constantly fixing it. Then they never got to that point before the Linotype took over. All right, there's my spiel about it.
And here we are with Mergenthaler has just expressed his fealty to the concept of journalism, even though he's a production guy. He's inventing things, but everybody in this movie has to pay some obeisance to the idea of journalism.
Mergenthaler was kind of apparently, I don't know, he was a cranky. He's very angry and he quit the Linotype company. And then he would like, so the first machine was released like this in 1886 is accurate. One of the New York newspapers started using it one, but then he like completely tore the machine apart and completely redesigned it within about 4 years to make the machine that we consider more like the Mergenthaler, the modern Linotype than when we think about.
I did see him showing the little matrices and explaining the flow of it, which was quite fun.
Mergenthaler's construction as a supporting character in this is to me, if you're an LTS listener who hasn't already watched Pickup on South Street and listened to the episode about Pickup on South Street, which I'm very sad to have missed because I love Pickup on South Street so much. One of the things Fuller does so well as a screenwriter and director is build a truly ensemble sort of setup with supporting characters. They're not just there to move furniture for the rest of the plot. They're there to add more dynamism to the narrative as a whole, to make this feel like a slice of the world, not just, people who have a couple lines here and there for a functional purpose.
Sorry. Just love this bit where they're just literally sawing a table apart.
And he doesn't really have a complete stock company, but if you look through the list, there are people in this movie that you'll see in other Fuller movies. And as I said before, I just think they're so good. And the fact that they aren't stars means that he can kind of deploy them in any way and to any degree he wants to without having to worry about, oh, we have to give this person so much screen time. I mean, Gene Evans is clearly the lead, but there's a lot of other people doing a lot of other interesting things and you're drawn to them. And I think it's great.
I'm sharing right now a Linotype matrix into the to Zoom so people watching will see it. Sorry for those listening to the podcast later, there's no visual component, but put some links to things.
I mean, we could put
then a whole chapter, movie.
We could make images. I'll get you to send me the images. And we can
the stock company sort of thing that Shelley alluded to. There's Dick Elliott with the pipe sitting down. And I love that his IMDb bio is better than most IMDb bios because it just flat out, I'm just going to read it. In the 1930s, 1940s, and especially the 1950s, if a director wanted a short, fat actor to play a windy storekeeper or a raucous conventioneer, he might as well cast Dick Elliott.
Oh, this is very important. Type lice. This is probably the only depiction in media of type lice, which is a prank you'd play. And watch it. I mean, it's exactly what they're doing here. But this was absolutely, I can find accounts that date back to the mid-1800s of this happening. And I'll tell you more about it in a minute, but let's watch the, they're trying to initiate, this is part of the initiation. If you're a printer's devil, you're working on a newspaper, you gotta find the type lice.
Initiation for the devil.
Oh, let's laugh at the child. Everyone should laugh at the child we've just humiliated, but he's happy. So this is it's an old joke. And in fact, I read this beautiful account from the late 1800s in which a guy recollects this happening. Cause at the time they were using lye and other material caustics to clean the type. So people would get like lye squirted into their eyes. It's ridiculous.
It's not good. No. So this kid is probably not attending school. He is, this is his job. And, child labor. Hey,
this is his child's labor.
Yeah. In this era, the journeyman typesetters would start at age 12 or 13. There was a move to push that later to like 14 or 15. But 12 or 13, you could start as a printer's devil in your single digits. But if you wanted to start as a journeyman or apprentice typesetter, 12 or 13, do 3 years of that. And you have to learn every aspect of printing. Then at 17, with half your life gone, you go out to work.
Yes, Glenn, I agree. I'm so lovingly enjoying watching child labor for a kid who has no other options and forced hazing.
Absolutely.
Oh boy.
Okay, hazing. Now this is better.
Whatever happened to hazing?
Oh, this is the French thing, but there's a Scottish printer, a fella I interviewed is now in his, I think his 50s. He worked at the last metal newspaper in Scotland. He is so metal. As an apprentice in the 80s. And I said, oh, so what was your hazing ritual? Did you guys do type lice? He said, no. What we did is we had this glove. This glove was something you could handle the hot metal with. And we covered it with ink and they stripped you naked and they put you in the composing stone, which is the big flat stone used to level out type before it goes on press. And they would just grab you with this and grab your privates and coat you up and down with ink. And I was like, man, that sounds a little more severe than type lice. Holy cow.
None of this sounds pleasant.
No, it was Scotland. He was delighted. He's like, this meant you're part of the group.
You know, there are those people who go, I wish I'd lived in Victorian England.
I just assume Victorian England smelled terrible. That's as far as I need to even go.
Oh my God.
I was going to say
in the 1980s.
One other thing about Dick Elliott, the bio goes on. He was one of those actors who, whenever he appeared on screen, often for less than a minute, the audience would go, oh yeah, it's that guy. He really was one of those original that guys. And Sam Fuller, a lot of the regular guys that he would use were very much like him, known for that kind of thing. And elsewhere, we've covered the original Christmas in Connecticut from 1945, in which Dick Elliott is the judge.
Yes.
Big old newspaper. You see, it says fraud and U.S. loan to France. So we understand what's going on there. Also mud on the mud bucket.
Also his fancy facial hair, a Van Dyke, not a goatee. The goatee is an element of the Van Dyke.
Yeah, classified ads would have been the lifeblood of papers like this if they didn't have, if he's not trying to be beholden to advertisers, but subscribers. And they would set classified ads in like 5-point type. Like, and look at the lighting they have. The lighting here is pretty authentic. Like it's gaslight. And, you know, it was hard. But Mr. Yolanda
Mastrangelo. So it seems like the labor required to set classifieds in 5-point type would require them to be kind of expensive. But I guess if you have cheap labor, it's okay.
Yeah, you just replace, you know. Mm-hmm. The other side of the cuff. This is really good. I like this gimmick.
Is this like, is he reading the same stuff over and over? Or is he getting new cuffs?
He said, I got a spare cuff. That's why I left you the other one. It's cute.
Okay.
Well, and the, to this day, two different kinds of ink that somebody would be writing with. There's permanent ink and washable ink. And so on the one hand, it'd be like, why is this guy ruining his perfectly good cuffs? Well, you use washable ink, washes right off.
Do you just wash the cold cuff?
Yeah. Or you just,
is the cuff fabric or is it some sort of like pasteboardy collar kind of material?
Celluloid.
Heavily starched. Starch
cloth. Yeah. I'll show you his celluloid dicky later if you ask. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, that was not.
Oh, good night. Good night, Glenn Fleischman.
Oh, doctor.
No, in terms of like washing ink, seriously, you could use non-permanent fountain pen ink on a sheet of paper and just run it under water and the ink would just run right off of it. And there it is. So especially if it's a very stiff, heavily starched kind of fabric like that, you know, it's fibrous enough to hold the ink, but then you could run it under water and it wouldn't substantially harm the cuff itself.
I thought we were a geeky podcast network already, and now I feel like we have achieved a new level with this.
We achieved a new level 45 minutes ago, Glenn.
I was scribbling together my notes before we started with a pen made of silver nitrate celluloid.
What?
Yes, I keep it away from open flame.
Glenn, have we got any listener questions? Because I haven't been following that.
I think we've answered everything in life. So
that's true. Well, how could there possibly be any listener questions?
With the thousands and thousands of simultaneous listeners to this live stream, I'm surprised we haven't gotten more questions. But keep them coming, folks.
Gary from Paducah wants to know: Christmas in Connecticut, is it Christmas everywhere, or Christmas just in Connecticut? Thanks, Gary.
Charity begins at home. Charity starts.
So that, I mean, this kind of artful lighting. I mean,
beautiful.
It's just beautiful. Where else do you get this kind of intentional lighting design outside of noir?
I also got a light.
Yeah, and I wanted to call it noir lighting. It's not really because it's not trying to do the same thing, but it has a lot in common with noir lighting. Uh-huh. And there are many more scenes inside than you in a noir. Most of them would be. Either, well, I guess they'd be outside, but they'd be modern and you'd have like the patterns of blinds with shadows and stuff like that. But you don't see period noirs that often.
My God, she's got a tiara on. She's sparkling.
As you do. Oh.
The Ice Queen approaches.
With a cape.
She looks pretty amazing. This is great.
Her
hat and costume game is pretty good in this movie.
I am now Charity the White.
There's so much eye action happening here.
My coat is of many colors, except we're in black.
They are.
I'm shipping it.
I mean, this is full on explicit 1950s eye banging.
See, 100%. Agents of smooch material happening right here.
Oh, this is this
like,
movie
shove
is
all that paper off the desk and let's go.
This is like
paper off the desk and let's sign a contract. Sign a contract.
This is what's the movie with Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan?
Around the corner. You've Got Mail. Yeah,
You've Got Mail. Yeah. Or Little Shop Around, I'm sorry. Little Shop of Horrors Around the Corner. Well, the
Little Shop of Horrors.
No, that would be an accurate title.
I did that intentionally. That was not an accent. But it has got a little bit of that vibe. And with reverse positions, he's got the money. He's got the integrity. Not really. Maybe.
They're going to merge their mastheads.
A wonderful honeymoon, but not in a biological
title
basis.
I love this episode.
This is
take off those
talk.
Garters.
Is he like stroking her cape?
He is.
Wow, this is hot
yes,
stuff.
This is pretty.
That's, I'm telling
like,
you.
I love it.
How did this pass the code? Didn't the Hayes people come in and shut it down?
Are we going to see her ankles? At
my
some
God.
Point?
Her lower neck.
Oh. Wow.
Good Lord. Is this he going is to starting. Unbutton
it's
his
happening.
Shirt? Three
I'm
buttons?
Sorry. We need
I
to.
Wish I had
we
a
need,
fan.
We need to mark this podcast as explicit. 1952 explicit.
Right. The Incomparable has standards and we need to abide by them.
The Incomparable has standards. We are ignoring them.
Don't judge me.
The Don't standards judge are pretty low.
What, there is that movie. What's the one where they go to Miami? It's got the band leader. Oh.
Nelson Reno 911 Miami.
No, thank you.
I wasn't expecting them to kiss.
Oh my gosh. The movie with the guy who wants to put the, it's 1950s film, one of the screwball comedies. Not Gene Krupa. Who's the band leader? Is it Miami Story? Miami Beach Story? The one where it starts with a guy who wants to create a huge airport above New York and there's his wife leaves him and he follows
him. I was like,
there's a
band leader movie with Desi Arnaz in it, but
no,
not the movie
this.
You're talking about.
It has got some of the most explicit talk for a 1950s movie where he's unzipping the back of her dress. And Lynn and I watched it years ago. We're like, wait a minute, what?
I mean, if we can there's, find there, it,
I,
mean, it could
I would
be
watch
LTS
that.
Gold.
Because I'm mean, enjoying this. Like,
I love the metaphorical horny talk in Charlie Varrick with Walter Matthau in the 70s, where he's sitting on a bed and looks up at a woman and says, it's a circular bed. And he says, so how you feel about
circular beds
boxing so the sexy. Compass?
Wow. The star globe. I don't have a sense of the period dress for women of this era. She seems like they made an excessive amount of attention to her wardrobe. So I want to believe it's actually very appropriate or no? No?
I don't know the timing 1880s? Of it, but it is
1880s United
yeah,
States.
But I don't know what.
I
don't know.
It is to me. Yes, it is very accurate to the textiles of the time.
It feels like it would be pretty accurate in terms of mm-hmm. the cuts. And
well, and it feels like given her class, fabulous. I mean, she's wearing so many different outfits and she's accessorized and she does look intimidating and formidable, which I think a woman in her position would want to do.
Well, she'd need to establish quite a lot of authority.
Yeah.
Oh.
Which is why she has a cane.
Well, directly the most oh. comparable thing is you ooh, you like take you take
violence.
This movie, compare it action. To HBO's The Gilded Age, because this is set yeah. within that same decade
yeah.
in
oh
the
my
same
gosh.
Town.
Of course.
Yep.
Oh my that gosh, look at all this. Beating people up, breaking
this
down
is
newsstands.
More exciting than The Gilded Age.
It is. The Gilded Age gets real boring, but boy, are the clothes pretty.
It's really pretty. And that's why I watched three episodes.
Yeah.
Okay, that guy with the beard is pretty hot, though.
I like his look. He's yeah. got a great look. And he's got a lot of integrity, is my thinking.
Beards have integrity.
Also, he wears a vest, which is...
Yeah, he's got that Alfred Nobel movie. Thing going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Alfred works Nobel and Dynamite, which are name-checked.
You call the butter, like you do better.
Ah, and then you go over here.
Thank you for that authentic frontier gibberish, Mr. Angelo.
Thank you, Dick Elliott. Where would we be with you and your frontier gibberish?
As you say, he's lots of westerns, lots of storekeepers, lots mm-hmm, of old coots mm-hmm. of various
he's so
kinds.
Also, in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Oh,
mm-hmm. one of the movies from the Golden
Year. They ran over Rusty. They ran over Rusty.
Not Rusty.
No, not Rusty.
Good God.
Sinner's devil.
This
We've
is
already
the, that,
hazed him.
Rusty. This is that dog's going to die thing, right? You know, when there's a little kid in a movie that's serious, his kid's going to be
Chekhov's
endangered.
Chekhov's child.
Oh,
Whoa.
This is amazing. In this film, all of a sudden, it becomes this brawling action film with fighting. Yeah. And
but with all this, the camera like is all so mobile now, whereas before it was so stationary.
Incredible.
Glenn, have you ever gotten pummeled at the feet of a newspaper legend?
No, but you know, there was a loyalist printer in the during the American Revolutionary War who he refused to stop printing loyalist material, and the rebellious folks came in, they chopped his press to pieces with axes in front of him, and then melted his lead down and used it to make bullets for the Continental Army.
Note that he's having to be very careful about the way that he slams the guy against the face of the statue, which is very clearly plaster over cardboard or press board.
And it feels like that was gentle. Yeah,
you don't want your fake on-screen stone to wobble.
Wow.
Amazing. That was...
Things changed rapidly for them.
Look.
Still hot, though.
You almost kill a kid. He's going to lose his cool.
The Palm Beach Story. That's what I was trying to remember. Have you done the Palm Beach Story?
Oh, haven't done it. Love it though.
That's a great Rudy Valley is who I was thinking of. The crooner, not
it's
the.
It's one of my favorite Sturgis ones.
I would love to do
another relatively recent addition to the Criterion Collection.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm all about Palm Beach Story. I think it's wonderful. That as well. I see, Glenn. When you said that, I was like, "You don't mean Palm Beach Story." And then you said '50s, and I just was like,
"Oh no, Ford,
being
I'm
literal
sorry.
About it." And
it's just a bizarre. It's got a wonderful film, but it has the steamiest moments that I've ever seen in a film of that era. It's post Haze Code, or no, not pre Haze Code, right? But
it's not pre code. It's in the mid '40s.
Wait, what's the? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah. But
pre code is before 1934 when they got away with a lot of stuff.
I'm sorry.
It's right, you know, World War II era. I mean, Sturgis. If anybody got away with stuff in that era, Sturgis did, and there's things like Miracle of Morgan's Creek that are just astonishing.
But
I'd much rather see Palm Beach Story. So don't get me talking about Miracle
of Morgan's Creek. Hey, Shelly, it's time for the summer of Sturgis.
I think you're right. You may be right.
It's alliterative, so
but
it is
I
correct.
Have my schedule all planned. How about September of Sturgis?
Well, September of Sturgis works, or next year could be summer of Sturgis. Well, recorded a year in advance.
Here's the
not
going to
say no. $5
Forgery.
$5 is a lot of money.
Yes.
Somebody 25? Is committing.
Wow. This feels like something that's going to break them.
Charity, her minions are still doing it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, finally, we get a good look at the picture.
Yeah. That is a jowly individual right there.
Those chops sure are muttony.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Where on the scale of Isaac Asimov to Andy Natko do those button chops fall? That's my scale, personally.
I mean, I'm assuming people listening to a commentary for a movie have already seen the movie, but the fading away of the star got bought up for pennies, and that is where the Toronto Star came from.
No, really?
Because we like to buy things cheap in Canada.
No, I'm just, I'm throwing shade at Toronto's premier newspaper that my girlfriend's writing an op-ed for.
Oh, your girlfriend from Canada. Yeah.
Yeah, my girlfriend.
And Annette, you don't have to take credit for anything that's from another whole other part of Canada. Unless
it's true. We are from
nobody
a different
in Alberta
area
cares
of
about
Canada.
Ontario.
Well, it's true. Even doesn't matter your political stripe. We all.
Yeah. Ontario needs to stay in its lane. Mm-hmm. And its lane is Ontario.
Not Canada.
Oh yeah, she's here. She goes.
We'd like to get us
reeling them in.
Mm-hmm. Is she the villain?
No, she's gonna bring it up.
No, she's got a line on the guys that are going out getting these fake receipts.
And a female bartender in the 1880s. She's my hero.
Oh, hey, call back to the styptic pencil or the indelible pencil.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
that's awesome. That's so good.
That is a really good bit.
That is genius. Also,
go get my shouty boyfriend.
She's lighting things on fire. She is pretty awesome.
Oh, just wait. If you've ever seen Flaming Drinks Mixed, this is one of my favorite screen depictions of it.
Well, given how this movie's going so far, I'm thinking that she's going to actually set them on fire to show them what they've done. Shot of Shanagaria.
Crazy cocktail.
I'm a little sad
right
that
there.
I'm not having fancy cocktails.
We should all be drinking that.
We should.
Uh-huh. Oh, there they are. Bang. Oh, there's Brody. Oh, let's just smack the guy on the head. All right. I love the printer. Printer's just like, oh, here's a billy cup. I'll just hit him on the head.
Hit him, George. Hit him, George Jetson.
Is that like a butcher who's just sipping away there?
This is a violent film.
What this is, I don't know, but I'm going to crush your head in with it.
It's pretty heavy.
It looks sharp, like a red.
It looks metal.
Excuse me. Let me spend the next 5 minutes explaining what this is. So in 1886, I'm sorry. I was joking. I don't know what that is.
I really thought you were going.
It's like, Glenn, that's why we brought you here.
I thought I'd misjudged it, and it was something that you did have prepared notes.
This is very important. Okay, so for next 20 minutes, let's just start with. 120 is going to cut the wood himself.
The technology of deeply angled glasses that rest right on the bridge of your nose, like this guy is wearing, essential to the Gilded Age.
Also, why haven't those come back in style?
Wait, why is somebody dead on the floor? Oh, no way. I'm sorry. They keep beating people up.
Mm-hmm.
Charity Hackett, Stephen Hackett's great-grandmother.
That's right. Oh, no, wait, they hurt Mr. Mergenthaler. This is unheard of.
Don't hurt.
Germans weren't considered white at the time. This is a hate crime.
That's right. That's a good point.
Nor were Italians.
This is right. This movie is God Almighty Moses.
1880s racism.
Are you trying to make the case that this movie is all full of people of color besides Charity Hackett? Is that
yes.
What you're saying?
It's a very diverse cast.
Oh my God. It's well, like thank you for
that
you saying
type
it.
Mess is going to take a while to clean up.
Yeah. I mean, being passed out unconscious, laying on that is probably a little worse than stepping on one Lego.
Now, for the lighting earlier in the film, I really had a lot of praise. This seems possibly
this is
a little
very dark.
Did they run out of money at this point?
It could
I
also
like the way it turned off. I like the lighting in the windows behind them, but you can't see what's going on in the foreground.
He's right. He said it'd take a month to separate this type, and he's right.
Right. This is also
the
fact that this is so poorly lit looking can also be a result of the fact that the movie was a massive financial failure. And for a while, the only way to get it digitally was from MGM's manufacturer on demand DVD service, which is how I bought it. And there are wildly varying levels of proper preservation that can be done to a film. And sometimes, you know, one reel or another, just, you know, the best remaining element is not as good as the rest of the movie. You know, just looking at the contrast isn't as good setting aside the composition of the shots.
you know, a lot of times when they can't find a reel for a movie, they wait until they can. They find some collector who has it and they get the best source and they do the best they can to digitize it, but they don't necessarily match.
Right. And until then, see, you know, you look at something like this, and this could have come from a 1-inch tape master, and all of the other shots come from much better quality film elements that they actually had, and various different vault fires and loss of preservation elements and everything are the reason that, you know, some movies don't exist in their entirety or at all. And to this day, I mean, the HD upgrade of The Tales of Hoffman by Powell and Pressburger that Criterion put out has newly discovered footage that had been thought to be lost.
What?
There's a really good book.
Plot point. Why is Mr. Davenport, why did he write his obituary?
Because he's just so dramatic.
He's all about the drama. I'm sorry. This is the one part I don't understand. They say he wrote his own obituary. He's hanging on the death hook and he's reading it. And it's this beautiful speech about blah, blah, blah. But I don't. Oh, I guess we find out. Maybe this is the part I missed in the plot. Never mind. I'm sorry, Shelley.
No, I was just going to say, if you're interested in film preservation as a more dramatic narrative than just the nerdy parts that I sort of like about how it's literally done, there's a book about the 1954 Star is Born preservation, which was done in the 80s. And if you watch that movie today, there are actually still shots because there are things that they could not find because that movie was cut mercilessly before it was released. And a lot of footage was lost. There's like half an hour lost because it was an incredibly long movie. And so if you watch it today, the 80s restoration has stills in it, but there was a whole book written about the making of the movie and then the subsequent preservation of it. That's really good. I can't remember the name of it, but I can look it up.
Why does Mr. I still don't understand why he's ready to die. Has he been dying and we didn't realize it?
He's the spirit of journalism, Glenn.
He's passed it on.
He's going to be at the point of despair. He might as well jump off a bridge.
He's going to coat himself in bronze and stand on one of those platforms outside and become a statue.
That could save a lot of time.
That would be more accurate too, possibly.
The Star is Born book has the incredibly inspired title, The Making of a Star is Born 1954 and its 1983 preservation.
there's a book that maybe even more difficult to find than when I came across it by Robert Carringer about the Magnificent Ambersons called The Magnificent Ambersons, a reconstruction because the original director's cut of it was famously lost because it got re-edited and only the re-edited version of it survived a studio fire in the 70s, I think.
Excuse me. Very important point. This is actually the amount of steam is a little bit over much, but this is actually a fairly accurate version of this is a later linotype. This is the machine he made later, not the blower version. You can find pictures online of Mergenthaler's blower. It's a lot more primitive looking than this, but this has this is kind of a later version. They probably pulled in from a shop and spray painted black or something to look like this. But
this is amazing.
The steam would not blow in your face. He did not design it
for steam to blow in your face. I just feel like regardless, there's a lot of heat in those spaces and the way those people are dressed. Yeah. It just seems like it'd be incredibly hot. It's
incredibly hot all the time. You're breathing in lead fumes.
Steam.
It's also super noisy too, right? Because I think one of the things I saw in the documentary, deaf people were a highly desired group of people because you wouldn't ruin their hearing. I have a goal of someday seeing a linotype in action.
They're all over the place. There's some in museums in Canada. I've gotten to set a little bit of type in a linotype.
We have one in Edmonton, I believe. Oh, in our
go break in the door. Get your camera.
They don't run it. I don't even know if it does run.
Glenn, she can also go during regular business hours.
She needs a break in now.
I could even get
if this movie has taught us nothing.
Go ahead, break in.
If this movie has taught us nothing, is you should use violence in the pursuit of knowledge. I don't know what it's supposed to do.
I know, but they don't run it. I want it to be running.
Why is Mr. Davenport dead? I still don't understand this. Did he die because of the
spirit of
journalism?
Because life isn't fair.
Mr. Davenport has given up the ghost.
He has to die in order to preserve the sanctity of journalism and to make the stakes really high. It wasn't
His
enough
blood
to run
is
over
being
the
used
kid.
For the ink
to be
of the
honest,
paper.
I don't even know who Mr. Davenport is.
He's that old dude who is the writer.
Okay.
The old fella. This is a great, great steam machine. Someone made a great little practical device there. I'm trying to remember. I don't know if the blower produced it like this. Usually you'd see the matrices fall down at a line so you can actually view them and then you'd turn a lever to get it to set. So this might be how the blower version worked. This could be accurate for all I know. That is not how you set up type. You would set it up on a composing stone because you wouldn't do it on the press. That didn't make any sense at all. But all right, it's fine. It's fine. Those are forms. They leveling the forms. Let's see. They should be leveling the forms. Yep. They're locking up the coins. It's Q-U-O-I-N. They're using the planar. You do the planar before you lock up the coins. Otherwise, you're doing the type. And that's actually all accurate. This is actually pretty good. No complaints, no notes.
Glad we watched like the whole movie before you declared it pretty good.
Well, only this part. Right, this accuracy of this part.
That's all right. It's
hey, everybody. You got to wait 100 minutes or however long before Glenn comes up with his. Actually, it's not 100 minutes.
Where are the comics? Sorry. Oh, that yellow kid. Oh, this is 10 years before the yellow kid. Sorry. Never mind.
I grew up enjoying the Chronicles of Prydain books by Lloyd Alexander and didn't realize until adulthood that he had written a trilogy of books called the Westmark trilogy that the central character is a typesetter.
Oh,
printer's assistant.
Oh, here we go. Cheese and rice.
Oh,
whoa.
Boom. Oh my God. So I tell you, explosions.
There is a bomb.
Amputations. Yes. This movie is about everything.
Oh, more bombs.
Throwing in.
But everybody gets out, like, it seems.
They're like.
So this was an important part of Linotype history, I'm assuming.
Yes. Things exploded all the time, but usually not bombs. That is pretty. I mean, that is pretty seriously something. I don't think I've ever seen a movie quite like this. It's full of technical detail about printing and then explosions and threat of amputation. I love it. And a romance. Love it. Love it.
Is it a romance with a happy ending or is it a tragic?
You know,
you have to wait
to find out.
Telling you.
I think I figured out what the Gilded Age can do in season two to get Annette back and to keep
bring in a linotype.
Oh my
Bring God, in course. The linotype.
Yes.
There's one of my favorite bits 100%. At the end of the excellent, the Saoirse Ronan version of Little Women at the end.
Oh yeah. The whole part in the print shop.
Yeah. And I was like, well, that's really, they really wouldn't do all that stuff together. And the bindery is different, but I was like, you know, they got the form of it right. It actually was sort of genuine to the spirit of it. And I was like, all right, I'll let them take like multiple different processes and times and put it all together. Sure.
You know what? We will do a combined episode, Glenn, where we talk about romances with print stories.
And be like, I love you. I love you. You know that, right?
The romance.
I love you too, Glenn.
Methyl sulfate.
My friend.
We are very good at the crossovers here at the Incomparable Friends. This is
incredible. Who knew there's been many films with, you know, printing involved.
Right.
Well, I like, it's Charles like, Darwin. I like books about writers and writing and printing.
Yeah. Somebody find me the fountain pen movie. Cause I don't know of one, but I'm surrounded by them all over my office.
Ayn Rand wrote a fountain pen movie, right? It's about Howard.
Exactly.
Howard Parker. Glenn, you're hurting me.
Howard Parker pens.
Glenn, you're hurting me in so many ways.
Do you know that Virginia?
My violent hatred of Ayn Rand.
Virginia Woolf, well, as is right. Virginia Woolf and her husband, whose name is escaping me, they were printers because.
He Wolf.
That's really good. They became printers because they were printing their weird writing. And then eventually they became so good at printing that they were complaining that all they had time for was to print because everybody wanted them to print their stuff. And they were producing, you know, eventually they got out of it. But the Bloomsbury, there's some kind of Bloomsbury press that was very, very primitive. But I know
screen printers who are so good at it that they are hired to do, you know, licensed pop culture prints by different outfits, and they don't have time to make their own screen prints to the extent that they would like.
I have found a
blog post called "Fountain Pens in Movies." So,
oh, Shelley, you found Moises, is this something for me?
Is this Lady Lazarus by any chance?
I'm the
screen printer. No. No.
Okay. No. They're out of, I don't remember where.
I think these folks are in your vicinity.
No. They're not here. They're in the Northwest the Northwest, the Midwest or Minnesota or something.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking it was the local.
They're various different outfits that do those things. And frankly, you know, even though Mondo is based here, most of their stuff gets printed by people outside of the state.
I have a Peanuts panel that was done by Lady Lazarus. That's why I was thinking about it, from given to me by Alamo Drafthouse for, you can not imagine this, providing them some extensive editing feedback on their labels for their explanation of flong in their Alamo Drafthouse in New York City, where they have a print place called...
hanging the newspaper on the death hook is a very God. Nice touch.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot there's a movie going
on. Look, the death of journalism.
The death of the Globe. Oh no.
You, son, what day is it? It's newspaper day, sir.
Buy a fine fat goose.
Buy me a turkey. Or a goose, yes.
Buy me a fine fat ways goose. There you go. There's a printer's joke for you.
Extra.
It's not extra. It's the first edition. It's not an extra. Well, I don't know. Maybe they just reprinted the rest of the paper.
Also, we have a boy working as a printer's devil. Oh. Apparently the newsies are adults who are hawking the papers.
I beg your pardon. This actually isn't extra because they reprinted the paper. So conceivably.
Look at them with their.
We were all blown up smugness. And you got. That's right. We were all blown up and you got stinking drunk, but we went back to work.
We because saved the day.
With all of our accents, we went back to work to print the newspaper.
Proving that immigrants work harder.
That's how machines work. They get blown up.
Dun dun. It's a romance.
I've had him ordered killed. He'll be dead by tomorrow. Oh, I'm
killed
sorry.
Him myself just now.
Strangled the life out of him slowly.
With my cane.
Oh, with a withering glare. Borrowed your staff, lady. Calm down.
8 pages? Where'd you steal all the news from?
From the Star.
Isn't she going to go to jail for being involved in betting fraud or something? It seems doesn't seem quite.
She could claim that she was just a poor little old lady and she didn't know what was going on. Which I don't think she did. Did she?
Glenn.
Aww.
Why is he dead? Why is he dead?
No one knows.
He's so dramatic.
You did that for me.
Swelling music. It's gonna happen. What?
It's just a model.
We didn't even get a kiss, though. I'm a little like, who cares about
it's implied.
The stupid you got statue your kiss
early. Not in front of the printers.
We just still don't know what happened to Rusty. Did he have to get amputated his legs or what?
Yeah, he just went away. It's like
he just went away.
30. Well,
despite all the talk about 30 earlier in the movie, when that came up as the ending line, I was surprised and delighted.
Pretty good. Well, excuse me. That was Park Row.
That was Park Row. Thanks, Glenn. That was fun.
I got
that was
good
fun.
Film. That was a good film. I think
was took you till 2/3 of the way through to say it was pretty. Well, I was worried because you were not criticizing the detail, and then by the end of your conversation about that scene, you had turned around. And yeah, it's pretty good. So,
well, I just mean about the accuracy of the. No, I think it's, I mean, I enjoyed the film, but I also think it actually is a good, it's a good tribute to journalism, sort of, I guess. I don't think it's a good tribute to, you know, consequences for one's actions. Cause we don't
I was like, is the lesson that we should create journalism by making the stories happen and having the stories ready in advance?
I think the lesson is linotypes are cool.
Linotypes are definitely cool.
Get into printing, kids. It'll only get you mostly maimed.
That's right. There's a big future in it. Just ask Rusty.
That's right. Well, you know, they probably got
if
a wheelchair.
If he can still speak.
Right. Yeah. Oh my. Yeah. I mean, there are some loose threads there in that film. Like, why is Mr. Davenport dead? Is Rusty still alive? Does he have the use of his legs? Did Mr. Mitchell just like,
okay, here's why Mr. Davenport's dead. Dramatic Gilded Age fatalism disease.
Oh, that's true. Well, he lead poisoning, probably.
That's a nasty disease.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. Well, thank you to everyone who listened live. And I don't know how many there were of you, but we know you were out there. We could feel you out in the dark. And those of you who are listening on the podcast, keep on listening to Lions, Towers, and Shields. Maybe we'll do this again because this was fun. And most of our shows are not live commentaries, but we do talk about old movies. And in almost every episode, we get an idea for a new one we can talk about. And Palm Beach Story might be it. Yes.
Well, there's one that you and I have mentioned in the back channel that I'm doing this. The doing of this made me yet more eager to wake up an opportunity to do that involves Zeppelins and parties.
Ooh. I'm into it. Yes, and we're going to revive that.
What? I want to be part of
Zeppelin's parties.
Satan.
Yes. Madam Satan.
No, I already heard that name.
It's so good. It's so good. I think we'll need to recruit some smoochketeers because it is a smoochy movie.
Yes, indeed. Well, thanks to all of my panelists. Thanks, first of all, to Glenn for bringing us Park Row. Thanks to Moises and Annette for coming along and sharing their love of typesetting and fountain pens and all those things. If you would like to keep up with us, you can do that at theincomparable.com/LTS. You can subscribe. You can find us on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield because S's cost extra. You can follow me on Twitter personally at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y. Send your movie suggestions. May or may not take them. It always depends on whether I can get up a panel. But we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Bye now.
S's cost extra and they were melted by your enemies.